alter and even erase his findings. Senators pushed to pass the Kids Online Safety Act and a call for Meta to respond. Annetta Felix.
I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you are tuned into WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM.
I wanted to start out with to play you a song, Ya Tal'in Ala Jabal, which was a song that was recently played by or sung jointly by a Palestinian woman and a Spanish woman. A Spanish woman who was singing Panaderas, which is about, it's like the bakers, and then we had the Palestinian woman singing this traditional song, which, by the way, was sung by Palestinian prisoners, specifically women, in the prisons, as you might know by now, because it's been said so many times every time hostages are mentioned, you know, that we always mention the thousands of hostages that Israel has it's in prisons for decades. So let's listen to Dana Salah singing Ya Tal'in.
Ya Tal'in, عين للجبل يا مول المقيدين النار بين لليمن يا مان عين للهنا يا روح ما بعتي منك للكم خلعة ولا لا 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 بدي زو النار بين لليمن يا مان عين للهنا يا روح إلا غزال اللي دي جوين اللي كم محبوس بين لليمن يا مان عين للهنا يا روح ما بدي منك للكم خلعة ولا لا 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 بدي ملبوس بين لليمن يا مان عين للهنا يا روح الحلم tasted freedom, soon those hellish skies turn to blue and starry nights as our voices start to rise. We're ending an apartheid.
يا طالعين عين للجبل يا مول المقيدين
That was Dana Salah singing, yeah, Talain al-Jabal, prisoner song that Palestinian women in the prisons used to sing. And she basically added her own English version to that. Today we're going to be talking about a couple of topics, really urgent ones. And just to let you know, just a recap of the main, you know, the main things that have happened in a week. And obviously there's, as usual, the way the world is in turmoil and there's a lot to cover. But I wanted to touch upon two things before we go into our next segment. And one is, as you heard, Israel bombed Qatar, Doha in Qatar, the capital of Qatar. Qatar is, for those of you who don't know, is a very close ally of the United States, and it has one of the biggest military U.S. military bases on its land, and it's supposed to have special protections and special privileges by, you know, courtesy of the United States of America, and also. On top of that, this is a country that normalized years ago, normalized its relationship with Israel and thinking that they'll be safe. Of course, no one is safe if you're a vassal state of the United States or the, you're not safe. Somebody said it's even more dangerous than when you're an enemy. Because they don't really care. So they bombed it, and they said that this was an attempted assassination of the people, of the Hamas leaders that were sitting down for negotiation, to negotiate a ceasefire in Gaza. And the mission was not, did not accomplish its goals. It did end up killing some Palestinians, but not the the targets that they were intending. And on top of that, Trump says that that the action was regrettable, even though the United States, of course, knew about this action. They can't have airplanes flying over, you know, the United Arab Emirates above the biggest military, U.S. military base in the Gulf without the U.S.'s knowledge. So he's, you know, the usual lies that it's regrettable that that this action happened and so on and so forth. Of course, this is all part, you know, what's happening right now. Just if you want to zoom out and get the big picture, let's get one thing straight. At this point in history, people are beginning to realize, including me, that it's not the tail wagging the dog. It's the dog, which is the United States, wagging the tail, which is Israel. So in other words, the fact that Israel invaded, or rather bombed, seven countries in the last week, just in the last week, and some of them allied with the Israel or normalized relationship with Israel, some of them have not, is very telling about that. This wouldn't have happened without the United States nod. This is part of a project. What Israel is fulfilling is a part of an American project, American government project, not the American people. American people are going one way and the government is going another. That this is part of the American government's project to reshape the Middle East, in a way that's more controlled and with having more access to its resources, even though that the issue of resources is becoming less of a motive. It's just about control and power. What are the countries that have been bombed? They bombed Syria, even though there's an ISIS leader that's allied with the U.S. and Israel. You know, you can't make this stuff up. They bombed Syria. They bombed Lebanon, even though our government in Lebanon, specifically the idiot prime minister that we have right now, who by the way, was part of the ICC, one of the ICC judges. In fact, he was at some point the leader in the ICC committee that put down the ruling that Israel is, you know, is probably committing a genocide. They bombed, of course, about the bombing of Iran for 12 days, which, by the way, they're preparing to attack Iran again. They bombed Yemen and killed the prime minister and several ministers. And Yemen recently retaliated by bombing a newly built airport in the occupied territories, an Israeli airport. The genocide is continuing. The bombing, the blowing up of high rises in Gaza City, left and right, is continuing. They're doing it in the way they did the southern suburbs of Beirut in 2006, where they just use these bunker busters that go straight to the foundation, usually where people are taking refuge, and the whole thing collapses like a stack of pancakes on top of people. And of course, they bombed, they hit the flotilla, the Samut flotilla, in one of the boats of the flotilla in Tunisian waters, and then said it was a fire that was started from the inside. And obviously there was footage of it, of the drone basically hitting the boat. And by the way, just rest assured, the people repaired the boat and they're going on now. That was the boat that Greta was on. They're continuing right now. They've rejoined the flotilla. So rest assured of that. So that's what's happening. And in the meantime, the whole world is increasing. Record-breaking demonstrations are happening in Mexico City at a Residente concert in New Mexico, with hundreds of thousands shouting "Palestina Libere." Free Palestine, in Australia, record-breaking demonstrations. Brussels, record-breaking demonstrations are happening. The world, there is a global intifada that is happening to resist this. And with that, I wanted to introduce the next segment, which is just a short bit that. The Ghadi Francis is a Lebanese Christian journalist that is addressing Tom Barak, who is the U.S. envoy, who recently insulted the Lebanese while demanding that the Lebanese resistance disarm, along with Lindsey Graham, who actually said when the members of the Lebanese government said, well, what if we obey by your conditions, what is Israel supposed to do? What it would be compelled to do? Or what are the conditions you're putting on Israel? And Lindsey Graham told them, don't worry about Israel. Israel does whatever it wants, but this is what, worry about yourselves. And in essence, this is a government that is corrupt, that is totally in the hands of the U.S. and Israel, but could not abide by these conditions because they were insulted so rudely by Tom Barak and by Lindsey Graham. So let's listen to Ghadi's response to Tom Barak.
Asking me to speak up against the American envoy Tom Barrack. I feel so sorry for the United States of America for having such diplomats. I mean, there was a time when your diplomats knew better or spoke better. I can't even imagine this person who has been tried in the United States of America trying to become a diplomat. He's a diplomat wannabe, coming and insulting the whole region. He's telling us we need to act kind and civilized. Tom, animalistic and uncivilized is Jeffrey Epstein, your buddy, your best friend. We don't know how much you have been involved with him and with the child molestation mafia that he had. Animalistic is invading Iraq and killing over 1 million people for nothing. Animalistic is staying in Afghanistan and killing the Afghani people for over a decade and then handing it to Taliban. Animalistic is your ally in Syria, the one that bombs mosques and churches and slaughters people. Animalistic is what you've done to Libya. Animalistic is what you've done to the whole region. Animalistic is the genocidal regime you protect in occupied Palestine, that kills journalists on cam for a sport, that starves children on cam in live, real-time coverage. And you have the audacity to come and tell us to act civilized? This is where civilization started. You have been trying for so hard to become a Lebanese, to claim a Lebanese identity, because you have no civilization. And if you tell yourself you're Lebanese, you might get a chance at being civilized. You come and you say this to the press inside the presidential palace. This while you go with your ally, the Israelis, who kill journalists for a sport, trying to protect them furthermore, without even getting us any concessions while our land is occupied, while our skies are being, every day they're being breached. The ceasefire deal that you harbored in Lebanon, it's just a joke. Your mediation is just a joke. You couldn't even free any Lebanese prisoner, any Lebanese civilian. You couldn't even get any concession from the genocidal occupation in Israel, from the people who were tried by the ICC for war crimes. And you have the audacity to come and say and defend Israel from the Lebanese podiums and to even talk to Lebanese journalists like that. Animalistic is you. And the administration that sends envoys like you. Do you remember what happened in the 80s in Lebanon? There was one language to be spoken to the Americans in Lebanon. And if you continue to send Barbies and condescending pigs, this is what you're going to get from
What's
Lebanon.
What's happening in Gaza is a Holocaust. And what is currently being designed by the Israeli government is the final solution to their Palestinian problem. And as a Holocaust survivor, my reaction is, not in my name. Extermination, dehumanization, starvation, blockade, lack of water and medication, the destruction of the health service, the hunting down of doctors, the hunting down of journalists, safe places which turn out to be not safe at all, but traps, concentration camps, all this together makes a clear Holocaust. Clearly, all these elements are not in any way different from similar actions by the Nazis during the Second World War. Gaza is an open-air concentration camp. In a sense, it's an extermination camp because there is no way out other than dying through bombing or disease or lack of food. Only alternative is to agree to be replaced somewhere where you don't want to be. I had not only the experience of the Holocaust and the hiding and the discrimination, etc., but the fighting went through our particular area where we were hiding. When we came out, when it was all over, I saw total devastation. Just like when you see the pictures of Gaza, destroyed buildings, piles of rubble, dead horses, dead people. I see exactly the same in Gaza. However, the great difference is that what I witnessed was a byproduct of two armies fighting. And what I see in Gaza is a deliberate destruction. And I think it's a degree evil, greater evil than what I've seen. The license which has been employed against the Palestinians, it's all based on the Holocaust experience. But rather than making the conclusion that this is something that we have to learn from and make it impossible to be repeated to any other people. They are actually using it as a license to complete lack of accountability towards any other people. I'm thinking now of when Netanyahu says, never again is now. This is a very clear reference to the Holocaust experience, justifying whatever they are doing. They are permanent victims, no matter how aggressive they are towards others. And another example, when the Israeli ambassador to United Nations, before making his contribution at the Security Council meeting, very theatrically put on a yellow star. I found that particularly upsetting and disgusting, because I had to wear the yellow star, even at age 7 in 1944. But they continually making this connection and using this cover to acquire impunity, total impunity. And that is deliberate policy of the Zionists and the Israeli state. They create an increase of anti-Semitism the world over because they conflate Judaism with Zionism and their current policies. And as we know, a very large number of Jews who have a sense of justice are against it all. And yet they pretend to be speaking and acting on behalf of all Jews. It's amazingly damaging to Jewish people the world over. So not only has it become obvious that the Israeli state and Zionism are producing a genocide in Gaza, but it is actually the very worst thing that could have happened to the Jewish people who are associated with these dreadful acts. For Jewish people, and particularly anyone who survived the Holocaust or their descendants, to dissociate ourselves from the actions of the Zionist state is extremely important. And how important it is proven by the reaction we get from the general public, who are grateful for our stand, making it clear that the Jewish people are not a solid block on the side of the apartheid and genocidal Israel. Because due to the Holocaust, Israel and the Zionists claim total impunity, and we see it in practice that this is accepted all round. They should not be in any way free of being called out as fascists, like we call out fascists elsewhere where we see them. And sadly, Israeli policies are now driven by clearly fascist characters, Ben-Gavir and Smotrich, amongst others. The comparison between the extreme actions of the Zionists and the Nazi regime has a long history. Albert Einstein and Hannah Arendt, in their open letter in 1948 in the New York Times, signed by many others as well, had already pointed out that the policies and beliefs of the Zionist organization Herut, which later morphed into the Likud party, had similarities in their ideology to the Nazis. If a comparison with the Nazi philosophies and practices was acceptable then, so soon after the Holocaust, it surely must be acceptable now, and we must protest against the taboo of not making any comparisons between the genocidal actions of Israel and the Nazi regime. This latest initiative of theirs of setting up a so-called humanitarian camp is just another concentration camp. Once entering it, and you are forced to enter it because there are no other places going to be left where you are free from being bombed. So once in that camp, you are not allowed to leave except, apparently, the plan is except for a foreign country. Supposing you don't want to leave, the conditions inevitably were so awful in these camps because they are overcrowded, there will never be adequate medical services available. So there will be slow diminishing of numbers by wastage and death through deprivation. It's a clear case of genocide. And the parallel is obvious with Nazi camps. Some Nazi leaders, well known for being kind to animals, and because the Jews regarded by them as human animals, they're going to be, like they would be to animals, humanitarian in executing the complete extermination. For example, by trying to avoid them knowing about their fates early enough so that they don't suffer anxiety. This was their kind of humanitarian approach to camps. So it's not a new concept, this kind of humanitarian camp idea. Once you are set upon an ethnic cleansing and a destruction of a people, it's inevitable that you have to prepare it with dehumanization of your subjects whom you're going to perpetrate all this on. Otherwise, you wouldn't get cooperation from anybody in executing this plan. I think the drip-drip effect of being brought up in these conditions distorts people's views, both intellectually and...
Don't you feel like, for example, children?
Children grow up to be Arabs.
And I found that, sadly, even a part of my family which suffered the Holocaust and ended up in Israel had been completely reformed by this propaganda. This even affected the cousin who was a teenager during her deportation to Auschwitz and was put to work in warehouses where they were sorting the clothes of those who were killed in the gas chambers. And one day she had to sort her own parents' clothes, which must have been an enormous trauma. Eventually, she came back, she survived. And when I met her in Haifa, I found her racist, completely racist, just like all the others. And frankly, I found it almost incomprehensible that somebody with that experience is still was prey to this propaganda. Any comparison between what's happening in Gaza and the genocide there and the Holocaust, World War II, and any denial or prohibition of a comparison is a taboo which must be broken, because it's quite clear and it's declared by the leadership of the Israeli government that the aim is ethnic cleansing and extermination.
אנחנו משמידים את כל מה שעוד נשאר מהרצועה ולא משאיר אבן על אבן. אני אומר לכם, פשוט תסתכלו על הסרטונים של מה שקורה ברצועת עזה. במשך חודשיים וחצי לא הכנסנו סיוע הומניטרי לרצועת עזה. האם הייתי רוצה להימנע בכלל מהצורך להכניס גרגר לרצועת עזה? גם לא לאזרחים? יכול להיות. גם מים אנחנו לא צריכים לתת לרצועת עזה. אנחנו מפרקים את עזה ומשאירים אותה כאויי חרבות עם הרס מוחלט וחסר תקדים בעולם, והעולם עוד לא עוצר אותנו.
If we witness what is going on daily, the continuous murdering of the Palestinian civilian innocent population, witnessing all that and not protesting or looking the other way is making us accepting a virtual rebirth of a fascist regime. And we have to resist it in order to be on the right side of history. And with regard to Netanyahu, he kind of impersonates all that. He is obviously a war criminal, as it has been established. But we mustn't make the mistake of thinking that it is simply to do with Netanyahu, because the leadership all around him, and unfortunately a majority of the country, are of the same mind.
If you gave me a button to just erase Gaza, every single living being in Gaza would no longer be living tomorrow, I would press it in a second. I would press it right now. Give me that button. I'd press it right now.
There you go.
And I think most Israelis would.
A recent Hebrew University poll has shown that 82% of the Jewish Israeli population agrees that there are no innocents in Gaza. And what is needed is a complete dismantling of the Zionist state and the Zionist movement. And we have to resist the tendency towards the travel in the direction of fascism at every stage, fascism, which happens in stages, incrementally. We can see this tendency, this direction of travel, already clearly in, say, Germany and the United States, particularly on university campuses. And more we find this incremental increase of limiting free speech and the freedom of protest here in this country. I was eyewitness to how the leader of Stop the War Coalition was treated. Suddenly, the police converged on him as if by an order and very violently knocked him down and piled on top of him. Because it was a totally unnecessary and shocking piece of violence, I thought it was intended as a message to movement supporting the Palestinian people, that they are after us. Subsequently, people that were standing right next to me, Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell, were called in for questioning under caution. Others were also called in for questioning under caution, including myself. It's a very difficult problem because at times to resist the official line and tendencies goes with great risks. Nonetheless, if you don't do it, you acquire guilt by association, by indifference. It's one kind of guilt. And there had been, in my experience of the Holocaust, very brave people who went against. It is possible, at great risk. Well, I just want to mention an actual example of how brave people can resist, at risk, certainly, to themselves, but able to resist the evils of the day. There was a friend of our extended family called Emil Wiesmeyer. He was an owner of a printing works. He was not Jewish, but was against what was going on. And at night, at his risk, he was printing false documents to save Jewish people. He took enormous risks. Obviously, if he was discovered, he would have been executed without any doubt. You got to take risks. This is the conclusion. If you want to be on the right side of history, you can't avoid but have to take risks. You don't have to be a hero, but you have to be able to take a degree of risk, a risk with your career maybe, or your qualifications if you are a student, which some very brave people are doing, but maybe this should be on a much larger scale. As the mainstream media turns the other way and minimizes or doesn't represent the truth about what's going on in Gaza and the West Bank, I think it's extraordinarily important to have platforms like Double Down News, which does tell the true story. And I think it should be supported. So if you can, support Double Down News on Patreon.
And that was I guess you can call it a testimony by a Holocaust survivor who survived the Holocaust firsthand and is calling what's happening now, of course, a genocide, and explaining why and the parallels. He, even at some point, he calls it to be worse because there was a war going on in the genocide that he survived, in the Holocaust that he survived, but there isn't a war. There's a deliberate ethnic cleansing, a one-sided one, by the way, supported by the biggest nuclear powers in the world, the United States of America, the European Union, and of course, executed by Israel. And not to mention that other countries, Scandinavian countries that are involved in it, that are now shedding responsibility from it and tacking away from it. The next segment, this is so important. This is such an important story. I mentioned it last time. This is about in relation to the book, the Fort Bragg Cartel, Drug Trafficking, Murder in the Special Forces. And it's become, even though it's a recently published book and it's on the bestseller, on the New York Times bestseller list, it's even becoming more relevant right now, as Fort Bragg, by the way, was called for a while. They changed its name from Fort Bragg because Bragg was associated, of course, with the Southern forces. In the Civil War, they changed it to Fort Liberty. And recently, under the Trump administration, they changed it back to its southern roots, to Fort Bragg. And the use of these special forces, whether it's the SEAL or JSOC or the Delta Force or the Green Berets, they're all implicated in Fort Bragg in the drug trade. At one point during the occupation of Afghanistan, this is mind-blowing, that the under the occupation, the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, during that time, the heroin trade increased so much by the allied, for example, members of the Northern Alliance of Afghanistan, basically the U.S. government's allies, they were trading freely and allowed to do it. And also members of special forces were also trading and partaking in these drugs, and they end up murdering each other, murdering their wives, murdering their pets even. It's an unbelievable story. You have to read it. But and the heroin trade expands to a degree that just the Afghani heroin trade could have supplied the whole world over. And it's all because of our intervention. And the irony of ironies, it wasn't the Taliban doing it. The Taliban were opposed to it. It was our allies and the U.S. forces that were involved in this. So let's listen to a bit. Already, Amy Goodman did an amazing job, of course, as always, of interviewing the author. But here he is talking to Breaking Points.
Joining us now is journalist Seth Harp. He is the author of an explosive new book. Let's go ahead and put it up there on the screen. He's been teasing it to us now for quite some time. The Fort Bragg Cartel, Drug Trafficking and Murder in the Special Forces. Seth, you have been making the rounds now with this book, with some extraordinary new reporting and revelations. But at a very high level, why don't you just describe what you found at Fort Bragg, the consequences of our 20 years of action abroad, and what it wrought with the U.S. Special Forces inside of their community.
Sure. The book is basically an investigation into some unsolved murders that took place on Fort Bragg among Special Forces soldiers who were involved in trafficking drugs. But in the course of investigating those murders and trying to determine who committed them, I came upon a much larger story of drug trafficking and impunity at Fort Bragg, culminating in a huge number of soldier deaths beginning in 2020 and continuing all the way through 2024. So the book really draws in a lot of those themes. And as you said, tries to show how that very high mortality rate and high rate of criminality in the Special Forces and the Airborne Corps is attributable fundamentally to the way that our soldiers and troops have been used over the past 20 years of forever war.
And Seth, the book reads like, I mean, the structure is, I think, really well done. It reads like a murder mystery, and then you also zoom out and talk about these broader implications. And one of the pieces you really dig into, which I'm shocked hasn't been fully explored to my knowledge previously, is the way that our war in Afghanistan helped fuel a drug crisis here at home. Can you lay out some of those connections for people? Because, you know, and I'm sure that this was part of the story that we've told here is that, you know, you had the increase in Purdue Pharma and these other pharmaceutical companies start pushing Oxy, people get addicted, then they turn to the street. I'm sure that's one part of what was going on here. But take us into your reporting on how the Afghan drug trade, you know, fueled by our war there, ends up coming back home.
So the narrative in which heroin addiction in the United States is precipitated by overly lax prescribing practices around opiate drugs. That's true. That's not a false narrative. However, what it leaves out is that during the 2000s and 2010s, there was a flood of supply of heroin in the United States, enormous availability, high potency. And my book tries to show how the majority of that heroin came from Afghanistan while it was under occupation by U.S. forces, which is an angle of the war that has not been thoroughly explored to date.
So one of the things, Seth, I wanted to get into were some of the really extraordinary stuff that you uncovered in your book. I mean, just pure, like, wanton behavior, you know, by some of the troops that you're alleging there. Can you go into that, including titanium teeth for dogs and eating human flesh? These have been the most controversial claims you've made in the book.
So that detail is really a passing detail in the book. However, it is something that people seized upon online. There was an operator who was suffering from extreme moral injury, PTSD, drug addiction, who was involved in the drug trafficking activities at Fort Bragg. His name was Billy Levine. He had been a dog handler on Delta Force. And in fact, he had adopted one of the unit's working animals after it had been retired. And I related a story that Billy told to the sister of another Green Beret, in which he said that the dog had had its titanium teeth removed upon retirement in order to prevent it from posing a danger to people, because while in service, the dog had actually developed a taste for human flesh. Again, this was something in the nature of hearsay that I repeated in the book. It was a credible enough claim, but people seized upon that online and were saying, this detail has to be made up. However, no sooner did that pylon begin than somebody anonymously posted a video of a clearly marked Delta Force canine, or a Special Forces canine in any event, doing almost exactly what I had described in the book. I don't want to horrify people by describing it in graphic detail, but it was amazing to see video evidence of exactly what I had alleged emerge just like that.
Mm-hmm. Seth, not to turn this into a gotcha or anything, the reason I'm asking is I did have some people in the community reach out to me about your book, and they knew that you and I were close, and they were alleging that you had not reached out to them for comment in some of these specific instances. This isn't to put down your work, but I do want to ask you, because some very specific claims have been made here about not being reached out for comment specifically on some of these allegations, using some of the hearsay and other things, and then claiming a firing, I believe, of a person claiming a voluntary leaving when they were fired in one particular case. I want to give you a chance to address that just to get it on the record.
Sure. That's just not true. We contacted everyone who's named in the book or made an attempt to contact them. If they are named, we made an attempt to contact them. And all of the allegations that we make about the unit, that we make about Delta Force, about the Special Forces, all of that has gone to the Special Forces Command with an opportunity for them to comment. They have declined every single time, including most recently when Politico did an excerpt. We sent them a very long email outlining every single thing that we were going to say in the article. And they said, because your question involves a special mission unit, we cannot comment. So I find it to be kind of a double game they're playing, where at the one point they hide behind, you know, the unit secrecy and say that we can't comment on any of these allegations. And then when the book comes out, they say, well, you didn't really talk to any of us. Mm. It's also not true that I didn't interview Delta Force operators. There's several who are named in the book, and there's even more who spoke to me completely off the record on condition that I not even describe them. So the idea that no one was contacted, that there were allegations that were a surprise, people are just simply making that up. I don't know where they're getting that. We don't go into that. We don't say every single comment is recited in the book, because that gets boring. But that allegation is completely baseless.
I wanted to make sure it was addressed.
Let's talk a little bit more about Delta Force, which is where you focus your reporting. I mean, first of all, for people who don't know, where did Delta Force come from? How was it established? And in what way have they been used and deployed during the war on terror in particular?
So Delta Force started out as a very specialized and very elite counterterrorism unit in the early 1980s or in the late 1970s originally. For many years, it was not used very often because of its high degree of specialization and use in things, rare missions such as hostage rescue. It continued to have that niche role after 9/11, and it wasn't really until the surge in Iraq in 2007, 2008, as I relate in an early chapter of my book, in which the unit became something much more of a death squad that was used in night missions, going out night after night and just hitting targets that were believed to have something to do with the insurgency in Iraq. And that was a model that was expanded to Afghanistan during President Obama's term in office. And we heard a lot about this when it was called by the euphemism night raids. Drone strikes and night raids really became the entire American war effort. And Delta Force was always at the leading edge of that. Other people in the Special Forces community have criticized, because I follow the message boards. The book has become very controversial among these folks. And one thing that they were saying was that, you know, and a lot of times when they hit targets, they're just capturing targets, and they're quibbling with the idea that Delta just shows up and just massacres everyone on site. Now, it's true that Delta Force does do capture missions. That certainly happens. I'm not in a position to say what the exact proportion is. But also, just last night, I saw some comments by a former Delta Force commander named Jeff Teagues, in which he was saying basically the exact same kind of things as I was saying about the UN. He says, when we show up, we will kill you, your family, your village, your pets, your goldfish, was an exact quote from this individual. And he added that when the black helicopters show up, everyone dies. That's coming from a Delta Force commander to a podcaster named Dalton Fury just a few days ago. So I stand by my portrayal of Delta Force in the book. It was based on rigorous research and investigations and interviews.
Seth, to me, if I zoom out, and I know this all sounds tedious, but as you know, when dealing with special forces people, they like to get into the weeds. Controversy is very big amongst them. They enjoy sniping each other on podcasts. Yeah. Don't ask me why, but this has been long part of their own community. When I zoom out and I think about your book, it's about the toll that the forever war took on the people who fought them the most, the psychological toll, and the lack of leadership from the Pentagon and others to recognize of what 14, 15 deployments of gangsterism, of just, you know, wantonly going in, running missions under the cover of darkness, of killing people, even capture, even if you're doing so legally, you're not doing anything wrong, I'm saying, but what that is going to breed into you as an individual. And what you write in the book is to show all of these unsolved murders on a per capita basis, you know, exploration of drug use, of the psychological toll that it takes on anyone to serve in this type of environment. And I'm just saying, within that context, is that how you viewed the inevitable rise of what you say is the Fort Bragg cartel?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm not trying to portray some of the enlisted operators who the book follows their careers and their lives and their deaths. I'm not trying to portray them as monsters. On the contrary, I try to portray them very much as humans and show how they started off from a place of good intentions, started off as normal guys, joined the military, progressively rose through the ranks and became more and more inured to the nightly killing fests in Iraq and Afghanistan and the terrible consequences that had on their bodies, their minds, and their souls. Inevitably, this is what our foreign policy breeds in, you know, military bases like Fort Bragg and in the lives of these people who get chewed up and spit out by this system, which, you know, it's a policy to use just these, just the special forces groups and the Navy SEALs and other elite formations to prosecute these wars that we maintain because American voters don't want to see large divisions of troops deployed to foreign countries. They don't want to see conventional troops coming back in body bags. And so relying on the special forces to wage wars out of sight and out of mind of the public is really, I think, a deliberate policy choice. But you end up with having the same guys deployed again and again, 10 times, 12 times, 15 times to these war zones. And that just says terrible things to a person, as you say.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I can't imagine what it does, too. If you've killed on behalf of the U.S. government and you come to lose faith in that mission, like the level of moral injury and the level of nihilism that would instill in you, is beyond fathoming. I'd love for you to take us through a specific example here, if we can zoom into the micro, just so people can get a sense of some of the, the murders that you detail. One consistent theme also is the lack of accountability, because these guys are so valuable to the U.S. government and probably know so many things that they don't want coming forward as well. So that's another significant piece of the story that you're telling here. But tell us about the beheading of Enrique Roman Martinez, which is one of the stories that you detail in the book.
Yes, one of the strangest episodes of this spate of murders at Fort Bragg was the death of Enrique Roman Martinez. Now, he was a little bit different from my other subjects. He was a very young soldier in the conventional army in the 82nd Airborne Division. He disappeared on a camping trip with several of his fellow soldiers from Fort Bragg, who told police the next day that they just woke up and he was gone. By the way, Enrique Roman Martinez, although by all accounts he was a nice kid, he was dealing drugs on Fort Bragg. In fact, he was deeply involved in that world. He was selling psychedelic drugs, in particular, out of his barracks room. And so that was an important detail because that same night, the night they went on a camping trip, he also took a large dose of LSD and was suffering a bad trip. That was the last thing that his friends knew of him. They said they woke up the next morning, he was gone. However, a couple of days later, his decapitated head washed ashore on the beach where they had been camping or nearby, on a nearby island, showing that he had been murdered. Several medical examiners determined that his head had been chopped off with a hatchet or axe or some other kind of heavy and sharp hand tool. It is one of the most mysterious and baffling cases in the annals of military crime. And I devote two chapters dedicated to getting to the bottom of this mysterious case, which almost ends up being like an episode of the X-Files more than some of the, you know, sort of like mafia style crime that the other murders were characterized by. So the case of Enrique Roman Martinez is in the mix in all of this. And I hope that my book will provide the definitive account of what's known of his murder to date.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting question. What was your goal in writing the book, Seth? There seems to be this theory amongst these former Fort Bragg guys that, like, he wanted to embarrass us or any of that. I mean, knowing you a little bit, I don't think that was really your goal at all. Outside of being journalistically interesting, were there any policy takeaways that you would have liked to have seen as a result of the book?
Yes, there certainly were policy takeaways that I came to, but originally, no, that wasn't my intention. I certainly didn't set out to write a book about policy. I really wanted to get to the bottom of the murders of Billy Levine and Timothy Dumas.
Yeah.
That took place on Fort Bragg. That was fundamentally my goal that drove the whole project from the beginning to end. But in order to understand those two men and what they were up to, it was necessary to delve into their respective lengthy military histories and provide the context of the wars they fought in. And in doing so, I'm not going to sugarcoat what these wars have been all about or what the unit is like. And so regarding policy changes that I would like to see, there are many. I think our military is in deep, deep need of reform. Really, the most fundamental policy change wouldn't be directly to change anything about the military so much as to wind down all these foreign wars and not have the need to have these small units going out and doing assassination and abduction missions almost every night, which, by the way, they continue to do in Iraq and Syria with virtually no media coverage of it and very little oversight from the Trump administration. So foreign policy changes, I think, are more vital than specific technical changes to the structure of the military. But down there, you could also advocate for certain policy changes. I think the use of special forces should be de-emphasized. I don't think it's a successful strategic model. The idea that we're going to use elite troops, intelligence agencies, you know, the Air Force and the surveillance apparatus, proxy forces, you know, this whole model of warfighting that developed under the Obama administration, I think has been a total failure.
I agree.
And so, moving towards a more conventional military, winding down foreign wars, I think those are the two most critical things that would alleviate some of the criminality and mortality we've seen at bases like Fort Bragg and also Fort Hood and other bases too.
Really well said.
President Trump has increased the defense budget, of course, most presidents do, and it's now over $1 trillion. How effective is our military? How capable are they?
I think people complacently assume that because we spend $1 trillion in our military every year, that we must have, you know, the greatest fighting force on earth. And that's just not true anymore. The military spending is so incredibly outrageously wasteful that it's hard to see where all the money goes when you're actually looking at the military. You know, I was at Trump's military parade not too long ago, covering that. And it did not look like a force that $1 trillion had been spent on by any means. You know, a lot of the armored vehicles, all of the military's workhorse armored vehicles are so badly out of date, 40, 50 years old in some cases. You know, the Black Hawk helicopter is performing really poorly. There have been an incredible number of helicopter crashes recently, another subject that's been underreported. But it culminated in the crash of that Army Black Hawk helicopter with a...
That was the Breaking Points talking with the author of the Fort Bragg Cartel. And the summation at the end that he made is that these trillions of dollars that are going to fight the drug war and to fight terrorism has actually increased terrorism, has increased in fact domestic violence. I mean, within 2 years in Fort Bragg, 104 people, mainly special forces folks, were killed right? And only a couple of them were killed overseas. These are people that are killing each other, hopped up on fentanyl and other drugs, and killing their wives and pets and so on. It's really, I think, the biggest story of the century, because it really shows how, since the turn of the century, we've been heading to this disaster. Tune in next time on the Shayam Na'na Show on Wednesdays at 2 p.m. This is Zain signing off.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, September 10th. Here are some headlines. President Trump's 30-day public emergency declaration in Washington, D.C. expires at midnight, ending the federal takeover of the city's police department, but not the presence of the military in the nation's capital. The National Guard and some other federal agencies will continue their deployment, and it's not clear yet when that might end. Meanwhile, the battle over how D.C. is governed is far from over. Starting today, the House Oversight Committee begins markup on 13 GOP proposed bills that could seize more federal control over D.C. If passed as written, they would restore cash bail, enforce mandatory sentencing minimums for certain crimes, criminalize outdoor encampments, and lower the age from 16 to 14 for juveniles to be tried as adults for certain violent crimes. In other news, more than a dozen Russian drones entered Poland overnight, prompting NATO to scramble fighter jets to confront the incursion. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
Early this morning, numerous Russian drones entered Polish airspace, causing jets to be scrambled and air defenses to activate. The drones did not appear to be carrying weapons, and many were shot down by the Polish and Dutch air forces. The incursion prompted many of Poland's busiest airports to be shut down. Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk called it, quote, "the closest we have been to open conflict since World War II," end quote. And indeed, this incident makes Poland the first NATO country to directly engage Russian forces during the Ukraine war. NATO countries denounced Russia's incursion, which many think are a test of the alliance's preparedness. President Trump reaffirmed his commitment to Poland, which garrisons thousands of U.S. soldiers, and pledged to send more forces if requested. Poland has invoked Article 4 of NATO's treaty, calling forth all its allies to start formal discussions about security threats. From WPFW and WBAI, I'm Noah Portner.
In more news, international condemnation is growing over Israel's attack on Qatar yesterday, targeting Hamas leaders as they gathered to discuss a U.S. proposal for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Hamas said in a statement that its senior leadership had survived, but six people had been killed. The attack is the first publicly acknowledged strike on a Gulf state by Israel. Qatar vowed to retaliate against what it condemned as a violation of international law and its sovereignty. However, the country maintained it would not abandon its role as a mediator in many regional negotiations. Meanwhile, Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz said today that Israel's long arm would reach its enemies wherever they are, stressing that it would not hesitate to use all available means to achieve Israel's security objectives. An emergency United Nations Security Council meeting in response to Israel's strikes on Qatar is expected tomorrow. And in legal news, the U.S. Supreme Court is allowing the Trump administration to withhold over $4 billion in foreign aid, at least for now. Chief Justice